Well, I have to admit that whenever I ask you for cues to the pews, I'm always a little nervous about what I'm gonna get. Last year in particular, I thought, oh boy, I hope nobody asks me about transgender stuff because I just don't feel prepared to talk about that in a good and meaningful way. After a year of thinking about it and processing it a little bit more, I feel like I'm a little more in a good place to talk about it, which is good because I got the question this year. I am still no expert by any means, but here's the question that someone asked. Should we be doing more to stop all of the confusing gender issues taught at school to children of all ages? I feel so badly for the teachers too. Where will it all end? When they use they, them, it just sounds as though they are completely confused and lost. Should we be standing back and letting it happen? Is it God's will? Lots of good questions there. And so we have a lot to talk about today. Not just because there are a lot of questions here, but because this is a very complicated and very sensitive conversation to have. The questions are myriad. What is transgender experience? What's cisgender mean? Is transgender experience a psychological diagnosis? Is it a social phenomenon? What about pronouns? As Christians, how do we respond to these realities in our day and age? Those are really important questions, and we're going to spend our time unpacking those today. I hope you brought your lunch with you. I'll try to keep it brief, but at the same time, I want to give a fair hearing to this because this is a very real situation, and I need to frame the conversation in this way. These are your grandkids and potentially children that we're talking about. Chances are good that at some point you're gonna have, at least one of you will have someone in your family, a grandchild, come up and say, "Grandma, I know you're used to me being a boy, but I need you to think of me as a girl now, because that's what I am." I want to prepare you to be able to respond to that with truth and with grace, recognizing that these are precious lives that we are handling. And they need to be handled gently and lovingly and with great care. Susan Zudema, who came here on behalf of Why Not to talk about supportive housing for youth pregnancies, I discovered that she's actually written a book on the topic. And I've got a copy here that you're welcome to borrow. And I'll lean on her in a couple of places. She taught in the school system for a lot of years before transitioning over to Why Not. So she's got an insight into sex ed curriculum, it's very helpful. She says the ideals to which Christians strive do not leave room for hateful thoughts, words, or actions, and she's right. So, with that in mind, let's just ask and answer some of the most basic questions related to transgender people, and this is the most basic of all. What does transgender mean? I'll put my professor hat on for a second. To answer that, we need to talk about two very, very important concepts: sex and gender. Okay? So get these in your head: sex, gender. Scientifically speaking, sex is the objective biological features that a person is born with. So their chromosomes, right? XX for male, XX for female, XY for male, their genes, their reproductive organs. That's an objective fact. No serious scientists contest that. Sex is your parts that you are born with. Gender, on the other hand, is the internal personal sense of being male or female, and how that shapes how you see the world, how you interact with the world, and how then other people interact with you. So sex has everything to do with what is physical. Gender has to do with psychological, social. Now, traditionally, sex and gender have been interconnected ideas, right? If your sex is male, then your gender is man. If your sex is female, then your gender is woman. To quote the famous Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Kindergarten Cop, boys have a penis, girls have a vagina. You didn't expect to hear me say that today, did you? No. Watch Kindergarten Cop, it's pretty funny. So that's been assumed for many years. Recently, though, like 1950s, 1960s, transgender advocates began to argue that sex and gender are not, in fact, related, and that while you may be born with the sexual markers of a male person, your gender identity may, in fact, not be male. Susan Stryker, for example, argues that the sex of the body does not bear any necessary or predetermined relationship to the category, the social category, in which the person lives, or to the identity and subjective self of the person who lives in the world through that body. So this person says, there is no necessary and predetermined relationship between your objective sex and your socially conditioned experience of gender. The argument would go then that sex is something that you are born with, but what you live in the world is socially constructed. We build it ourselves out of the experiences that are available to us. We define our gender however we see fit. Now, for some people, that means saying that if you are born male, your sex is male. The gender may actually be female, and that's what you would call a transgender woman. On the other hand, some people are born with a male sex, but they will say, no, I identify as a female, and so that is female will say that they are male, that's a trans man. They would say that they are simply they were assigned the wrong gender at birth, and so now just because the doctor looked and said, "Oh, I've got a penis," doesn't mean that you're a man. They are then exercising their right to say, "No, actually, I'm a woman." So that's transgender experience. The tip of the iceberg. Other people, though, will argue that male and female are inadequate for describing their experience of gender. And so this is where the terminology of non-binary comes in. So if you remember Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner won some Olympics medals and then announced to the world that she was in fact a woman. Transgender, trans woman. However, you'll notice that still plays within the binary of male and female. There are others who will say, though, that just doesn't cut it, and that male to female isn't on or off. It's a spectrum that slides from one side to the other. And so this is where you will have people talk about being non-binary or being gender fluid, being able to go back and forth in their experience of maleness or femaleness. So to summarize all that I've just said, there's a test after, so you've got sex and you've got gender. Okay, you've got physical and internal, social, psychological. When those match, you have a cisgender person, C-I-S, cisgender person, like me. I am a cisgender person. If they don't match, though, you have a transgender person. Regardless of their physical sex, this person can define their own gender. And they can play by binary, male or female, or describe themselves on a spectrum, being non-binary or gender fluid or gender queer. Now, on top of that, you have the further reality of something called gender dysphoria. This is a psychological diagnosis, a legitimate psychological diagnosis in the DSM-5. That's the standard manual for mental health diagnoses. Gender dysphoria describes the feeling of distress, of incongruence between your sex and your gender. So a person can legitimately be diagnosed with the feeling and the distress coming from the feeling that they are a person living in the body of the opposite gender. That is a psychiatric diagnosis that some people have. It's not necessary, though, for you to call yourself trans. Now, I know that there are a lot of people who will hear that and say, well, that's silly. That's just baloney. But to be fair, I think we need to give people a fair hearing. Just because I haven't ever had an eating disorder, clearly, doesn't mean that anorexia is not real, right? We need to consider these things and give grace to people who are experiencing these things, because by the sounds of it, gender dysphoria is awful. A New York Times columnist says dysphoria feels like being able to get unable to get warm no matter how many layers you put on. It feels like hunger without appetite. It feels like grief without having anything to grieve. Another person online says it's like an electric current in my body that causes my joints to ache, my stomach to turn, my hands to shake, nausea in the most severe moments. It feels like cramming two wrong puzzle pieces together. It would seem that gender dysphoria is a legitimate experience, and we need to take that into consideration too as we think about transgender people. Before we do that, though, I think we need to switch gears a little bit and think about this from God's point of view. Because so far, everything I've said to you is fairly standard in the field of gender studies. And I hope that gives you a sense of the broader conversation that's happening in our culture. Because it's important for you to know what's going on, for you to be able to engage, say, with a child or a grandchild who comes to you and says, I'm gender fluid. Before we reach any conclusions, though, we do need to hear God and think about what God says about this. So what does the Bible say about transgender people? To be honest, there's no chapter and verse that I can point to because, frankly, the idea that sex and gender are not intimately linked is a pretty recent phenomenon. The Bible just doesn't talk about sex and gender in those terms. As Kevin DeYoung puts it, the Bible believes in the organic unity of biological sex and gender identity. They just go together in biblical thought. But I think that there are two other lines of evidence that we need to consider. First, the way that God made us, male and female, and the way that he distinguishes between those. So let's look at those. We're going to go to the Bible now. Turn with me to Genesis 1. Genesis 1, 26 and 27. We'll think about how it is that God made us in the first place. So Genesis 1, verse 26, God says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the seas and the birds of the air. God gives us stewardship over his world. And having decided to make us in his image, verse 27, God created man in his own image, that is, humanity in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. When God decided to make representatives for himself here on earth, he made human beings. He made people who would reflect his character to the world, who would take care of all he created. But in doing that, God didn't just create one kind of sexually identical being. He made male and female. God made this binary sexual distinction between male and female. That's Genesis 1. Genesis 2 doubles down on it. God creates all the animals, and then he creates a man and says, verse 2:18, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper and a partner for him. So what does he create? He creates not another man, but a woman. From the very beginning, God created a binary distinction between man and woman. Now, to be fair, you could argue that this is only talking about sex. That this is only talking about the biological fact of their maleness and femaleness. Adam was male, Eve was female, and their reproductive organs enabled them to create new life, just as God had done. There is no question that God created two sexes and only two sexes, but what about the question of gender here? That, I think, is where the other line of evidence comes in. There are a handful of places in the Bible where God calls us to not represent ourselves in ways that contrast with our sex, our physical sex. So Deuteronomy 22, if you turn to Deuteronomy 22, Deuteronomy 22, for example, says, a woman must not wear men's clothing, nor a man wear women's clothing. For the Lord your God detests anyone who does this. Stay there at Deuteronomy 22:5. I'm just going to give you two more verses, but don't turn to them. 1 Corinthians 6:9 talks negatively about malakoi, the Greek word that you would use to talk about effeminate men, specifically in the context of receiving in the sexual act, and people who dress and act like women. Men who dress that way. And then a couple of chapters later, 1 Corinthians 11 establishes the idea that there are things that are appropriate for men to wear in worship and things that are appropriate for women to wear. Now, this, I think, is very interesting because it pushes us beyond the objective fact of sex and into the realm of gender identity. Because how we dress is all about gender. It's one of the ways that we express and thus experience gender in the world. So let's take Deuteronomy 22:5 as a case study. It says a woman should not wear men's clothing nor a man woman's clothes. Okay, so just to take the first part. It says a woman should not wear men's clothes. Woman, in that sentence, is a marker of her sex, her physical, biological reality. Clothing, though, is a marker of gender, and that is socially constructed. We as a society agree together on what's appropriate for the male sex, what's appropriate for the female sex, and we just live with that in the back of our minds. 100 years ago, just to show you that clothing is socially constructed, 100 years ago, the women here would all be wearing dresses, right? And the men would all be wearing pants. It's not because pants are specifically male. It's because that culture deemed it appropriate for men to wear pants and women to wear dresses. I don't bat an eye, though, when Joyce walks in wearing pants, because our cultural convention says that that's fine, that it's okay for ladies to wear pants. It's just as appropriate for men and women to wear pants. It's a social construct. We use those social constructs to express our gender identities. Deuteronomy 22:5 then says, listen, if your sex marks you as female, don't take male gendered clothes and wear them, because that expresses that you're a man. Alternatively, if you are a man, don't use female gendered clothing to say that you're not a man. Genesis 1 and 2 say that God created male and female, not gender fluid, but one of two sex categories. Passages like Deuteronomy 22:5 suggest to me that we use socially constructed gender categories that are consistent with the sex that we are born with. And that, I think, is the main reason why choosing to be transgender is inconsistent with God's ways. It is expressing it's expressing gender in a way that contradicts the way God made you at birth, and it claims that you are something that you are not. Now, I know that a trans advocate would say to me, well, you are just a heteronormative bigot, unwilling to acknowledge that sex and gender have no real and necessary correlation, to which I would say, When you unhitch sex and gender, you have effectively emptied gender of any real meaning. Like, I spent way too much time this week reading LGBTQ resources to try to see how they define gender, and I can't find a good definition of gender for them without any relation to sex, right? In practical terms, if a woman's lived experience is not in any way related to her biological sex, then you have effectively voided the experience of being a woman of any meaning. It's not exclusively, a woman's experience is not exclusively shaped by her biological sex, but it certainly plays a part. And the same is true for men. If my gender identity has nothing to do with my biological identity, then you've effectively emptied maleness of any meaning. I've been spending the week going in my head, going, how does this work? How can you pull the two apart? And that's a problem because in God's eyes, he created us in his image, male and female. He made you to be a man or a woman. To say then that being a man is what you want it to be, or being a woman is what you want it to be, is saying that you know better than God, and that's wrong. The evidence here in the Bible leads me to believe that actively choosing to represent yourself in a way that is inconsistent with your sex is in fact inconsistent with the will of God and the way that he intended for human flourishing. Now, that being said, there are tons of implications to spin out from this. And this is where it's important for us to remember that this is one of your grandchildren that we could be talking about here. There are legitimately people who suffer from gender dysphoria, that feeling of distress, because their sex and gender don't seem to line up. We need to be very sensitive to people with that experience. If they are legitimately dealing with that feeling of unsettledness, then we need to embrace them and help them walk this road. The statistics around LGBTQ suicide and trans experience are brutally high, staggering. Upwards of 40% of transgender people have attempted suicide, like almost half. LGBTQ people contemplate suicide 3 times more often than heterosexual youth. That's awful. The last thing that we want to do as followers of Jesus is contribute to that. Our job number one is to love others as Jesus first loved us, fully, completely, before we got our act together. And trans youth need our support to carefully walk this road. So, that being said, let's go back to the question from the very beginning. Okay? There's a lot of issues wrapped up in it. Here it is again. Should we be doing more to stop all of the confusing gender issues being taught at school for children of all ages? I feel so badly for the teachers, too. Where will it all end? When they use they, them, it just seems as though they are completely lost and confused. Should we be standing back and letting it happen? Is it God's will? Okay. In my mind, there are three questions there that we need to deal with. First, should we be doing more to stop all the confusing gender issues being taught at schools? Steph, do you want to talk on that? If Jennifer were here, I'd ask her the same thing. So, what do we do? 2, what about pronouns? 3, what's God's will in all of this? I think those are the 3 key questions that have been asked here. Should we be doing more to stop it? What about pronouns? What's God's will? First, should we be doing more to stop all the confusing gender issues taught at school? Here, I'm going to defer to Susan Zudima, who spent many years in the public system. In her book, she acknowledges the danger of this sort of teaching in school and reminds us of the influence that, she reflects on the teaching at school, but reminds us that we as parents and grandparents and neighbors and friends can have huge influence on our kids and grandkids. And so she writes what's on the bottom of the handout there. As believers, we cannot accept homosexuality or transgenderism as human qualities that are morally sound, helpful, or true. Instead, we need to instruct our children in gentleness and forbearance, in the art of agreeing to disagree. But we need to make a clear distinction between tolerance and acceptance. We tolerate the practice. We accept the person. With our example, Jesus, friend of sinners, how can we do any less? Beyond that, I think that probably the best thing for us to do as Christians is to have these conversations in church from time to time, and to humbly live out the unique gender distinctions that God has given us. Now, that's not to say that we should live according to gender stereotypes, because not every man is going to love football and fast cars, and not every woman is going to love doilies and shopping. Again, Susan Zudema here is really helpful. She denies that there's a spectrum from male to female, but she says within male experience, there's a spectrum of maleness. And within female experience, there's a spectrum of femaleness. You can have tomboyish girls and girlish girls, and you can have sensitive men and warrior men, and they're all important and valuable in God's eyes. Susan says, the key message for parents to deliver is that their son can be himself and still be an excellent boy. Your daughter can be true to her interests and still be an incredible girl. Your children's interests or self-expression do not change their sexuality or gender. And I have to admit, I wonder if, to a degree, people are questioning their sexuality just because they don't line up with stereotypes associated with maleness and femaleness. Like, I'm not a manly man. I've felt incongruence on my part from time to time because I'm not overly handy around the house. But I don't think that should necessarily lead me to think that I might be a woman. I think it just means that I need to be the kind of man that God has made me to be. And you need to be the kind of man that God has made you to be, or a woman. I think that churches have a special responsibility here to not perpetuate gender stereotypes, but to instead humbly live with this knowledge that there are different kinds of men and there are different kinds of women, and that's okay and good. Because one of the things that really concerns me is what some researchers have called rapid onset gender dysphoria. So historically, the majority of trans people have been male, who have experienced dysphoria over a long time and then transitioned to female. Recently, though, there has been a switch in the trend, and there is this surge in teen girls who are out of nowhere experiencing questions about their gender, and like peer groups and social media seem to play a big part in that. To be fair, it may just be the growing acceptance of trans people, but like, man, the numbers are huge. Like 4,000 to 5,000% increase in female to male transitions over the last 10 years. 4,000 to 5,000%. And just anecdotally, there are so many stars and influencers who are coming out on Instagram or whatever and saying, I'm gender fluid. How can they not have an impact on our young people? As a church, we need to be a safe place where it is okay for people to work out all the confusing ways that the world is saying, and we need to love and support people along the way. What about pronouns? That's a tough one. There are two main streams of thought in churches like ours right now. The first would say that Christians are called to speak the truth in love and to call someone by their pronouns that do not match their biological sex would be to perpetuate falsehood. So somebody like Denny Burke would say, I must never encourage or accommodate transgender fictions with my words. I have an obligation to expose them. For me, that means I can never refer to a biological male with pronouns that encourage him to think of himself as a female. That's one way of thinking about it. The other way is what I've seen called pronoun hospitality. The idea here is to meet people where they're at and to use their preferred pronouns as a way to build a bridge to them. There's a practicing Christian psychiatrist, Mark Yarhouse, here. He says, using a person's pronouns is an act of respect. Even if we disagree, to let this person determine what they want to be called. If we can't grant them that, then it's going to be next to impossible to establish any sort of relationship with them. To be honest, I think this is a classic case of in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things charity. I get where both are coming from here. Personally, I would just tend towards gender-neutral pronouns and leave it at that. I mean, we already do that. We make use of gender pronouns in our world. Like when I say the LCW are meeting, I don't say they, female, are meeting. We just use the gender-neutral pronoun they and move on. But that's my kind of position, and I'm not going to have a hard time with you if you go the other way. Most important, third, what's God's will in all this? It's a good question. I don't think that God's will is for us to just toss sex and gender out the window as meaningless concepts. God made us female and male. He made us female and male for good reason, and it would not be smart for us to deviate from that. For that reason, I think it's important for us to hold to a traditional Genesis 1 and 2 defined view of human sexuality. That being said, I think, again, Preston Sprinkle, that's this guy, also a book you can borrow if you'd like, he says, the Bible's primary invitation to every Christian is to not become more like a man or to become more like a woman. It's to become more like Jesus. And Jesus constantly and consistently acted with gracious, life-giving love towards confused people. Like, think about how he interacted with the woman in John 4 who went through husbands like Kleenexes. Or think about the tax collector who thought life's goal was to die with the most toys. Or think about the woman who was caught in adultery. Jesus embraced each of them where they were at, but loved them too much to leave them there. He helped them towards the truth that would set them free. We need to do the same. So in practical terms, I think Preston Sprinkle is right. When someone tells you they're trans and invites you into a relationship, the best thing that you can do is to ask them what they mean by trans. Don't interrogate, truly listen. Listen with the goal of understanding and loving the person who is willing to tell us their story. To listen is to love. And I really value Mark Yarhouse's insight as a practicing psychiatrist. He writes, especially to parents here, first, when teenagers are making decisions about gender expression, they are often still asking the question, do you love me? We want to make sure that they know that they're loved. Second, your loved one may be managing their dysphoria by doing things like wearing their hair atypical of their sex or doing their nails or something, rather than managing the dysphoria, rather than intending to reject social norms or the specific teachings of a faith community. We have found it better to recognize those coping strategies for what they are and before inviting a person to consider any alternatives. This is a question that will not go away. And I suspect that we will have this conversation many times over down the road. So I'm going to end here and say, if you want to talk about this, let's talk. In all that we do, though, may we be a community that holds to the truth and loves people with the utter grace of God. Let's pray together. Jesus, these are complicated realities and sensitive ones too. They go deep into the heart of what it is to be human. And for a lot of people, it's hard to be the sex that they were born as. God, I pray that in all of this, you would enable us to bear your image, to be gracious and honest. I pray that when one of us runs into the situation where a loved one says, I'm a transgender person or I'm non-binary, I pray that you would give us the grace to love them deeply. I pray that you will give us insight into how to support them. I pray that you will enable us as a community to be a place of refuge and of hope rather than of condemnation. God, even if being transgender is not consistent with your will, we know that these people are valuable and loved by you. They are made in the image of God, even as we are. And I pray, Lord, that with all sinners, me included, you would enable us to be accepting and embracing, but to help each other out of the ruts of sin and to live in the fullness of truth that you have given to us. Lord, guide and direct. In wherever I have deviated from your will, I pray that you will make that clear in my mind and in the minds of others. Where what we have heard, what you have said to me through the week has been accurate, God, I pray that you will help us to live that out. And we pray all of these things in Jesus' name. Amen. As usual, I do post these videos on YouTube, and I also post the manuscripts. And this manuscript has more than 20 footnotes, because there's some stuff he just can't say in the sermon, but there are a lot of details here and a lot of other resources, so that if you're interested in diving into this more, there are these books that are available to you. My manuscript will be online if you want to go back over it and look at it again.